It's time now to begin the December surprise update. This is an update, literally, of what has now become, over a period of time, Radio Free America program number 35, the seventh broadcast in a seven-part and ongoing Radio Free America series dealing with the Iran-Contra scandal. Now, originally, back in January of this year being 1989, the December surprise was intended, of course, as an addendum to the Radio Free America's on the Iran-Contra scandal, but it was a miscellaneous show. It has basically evolved into, and it represents, I believe, more or less the denouement of the Iran-Contra scandal, at least in terms of a formal prosecutorial sense, outside at least of the Christic Institute's lawsuit. Now, again, the drug tug information, which we've been talking about, may, if it gets sufficient publicity and if the information bears out, that may figure in a big way in the Iran-Contra scandal in the future. But for the time being, the December surprise appears to sort of represent the wrap on the Iran-Contra scandal. Just exactly what the December surprise is, I will explain in just a second. However, I'm going to begin this particular addendum by giving a rundown of what it is we're going to listen to. Then I will get into the, or at least in a nutshell, the December surprise hypothesis, and we will proceed with tonight's addendum to RFA 35, the December surprise, the one-time miscellaneous archive show, but now, over a period of time, it has evolved into RFA 35. We're going to begin by taking a look at an account of a Jordanian national who was working for West German intelligence. A later account has him working for Jordanian intelligence, or actually working for West German intelligence on leave, or on behalf of the Jordanian intelligence service. Whatever the situation is, it appears that there is, or was, considerable contact between the BND, the West German intelligence service, and the individual who, at least in some circles, is being fingered as the probable maker of the bomb that blew up Pan Am Flight 103 in December of 1988. That particular event is the main event in the December surprise scenario that I'm going to outline in just a second. We're going to take a look at this particular account of Marwan Krishat, his contacts with the BND, which of course evolved out of the Galen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit during World War II, that eventually went on to become the West German Intelligence Service, and some of the junior members of the organization at the end of World War II are senior executives at this particular time. Then we're going to jump back in time, and we are going to take a look at a number of different events, but chiefly we're going to take a look at the career and influence of a man named François Jeannot, last name G-E-N-O-U-D. Jeannot worked for the Third Reich during World War II in an intelligence capacity. He was a Swiss national. He has gone on to play a very key role not only in the post-World War II Nazi underground, but specifically has been heavily involved with various Middle Eastern causes, and in particular has been involved with helping to bankroll certain Middle Eastern terrorist organizations which are most closely affiliated not only with the most extreme sorts of views and behavior of the Palestinian movement, which is itself an umbrella movement. It involves a number of different kinds of elements, many of them bitterly, even mortally at odds with each other, but many of the most extreme elements, the most violent elements, the most terrorist-prone elements over the years have been associated with residual elements of the Third Reich, and some of the people involved with those organizations go back to the Third Reich itself. We're going to talk about Third Reich influence and post-World War II Nazi influence on the Middle Eastern terrorist situation. We're going to talk about how that involves not only the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the organization Mr. Marwan Krishat, the aforementioned BND agent being fingered as the culprit for the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing. He worked for not only the BND, but for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the organizations very closely affiliated over the years with François Jeannot. We're going to take a look at Jeannot, and we're going to follow his career from the Third Reich up until the present time. We're going to be relying for our information on François Jeannot on the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. I'll give you all of the particulars on that in a second. It should be noted that this particular information, including many of the same excerpts from unhealed wounds are included not only in an addendum to Radio Free America program number 22, which is called The Terror Connection Part 1, Otto Skorzeny, and basically deals with Otto Skorzeny's influence on post-World War II terrorism. We're going to talk about Skorzeny here in a second. We're going to take a look at, again, Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, and we're going to begin by taking a look at François Jeannot's work on behalf of Third Reich Intelligence during World War II. We're going to take a look at his contact with and association with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who, in addition to being the religious leader, the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims, was also a major in the SS during World War II and a major player on the post-World War II terrorist scene, as well as the Middle Eastern scene. Haj Amin al-Husseini has gotten around. We're going to take a look at the Jeannot-Haj Amin al-Husseini association, one which was to bear bitter fruit over the years. Then we're going to look at François Jeannot's connection with a group of Third Reich alumni, many of them Nazi war criminals, that helped build not only the Egyptian but later the Libyan Secret Service. They did this on behalf of not only the CIA, or not only the Galen Organization, I should say, but in turn, at the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency. This group was led by Otto Skorzeny, involved many heinous war criminals, and it was, according to author Glenn Infield, this particular group which spawned the first Middle Eastern terrorist organizations. Author Infield, in the book Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando, specifically fingers Otto Skorzeny's contingent as having given rise to the first Palestinian terrorist groups, which marauded in the Gaza Strip during World War II. Not during World War II, but after World War II. We're talking mid-1950s. Excuse me, I misspoke myself. Now, we're going to take a look at François Jeannot's association with this CIA Galen contingent, and this is very important because that group figures very prominently in the history not only of the Middle East, but of Middle Eastern terrorism and world terrorism as well. We're going to take a look at François Jeannot's involvement with the post-World War II Nazi underground, and in particular, his role sort of as, I guess you could say, the executor of Hitler's will. We're going to take a look at his association with the SS during and after World War II. And in general, François Jeannot here is the key figure we're going to look at. We've not only looked at him in the addendum to Radio Free America 22, we also took a look at François Jeannot in a big way in a miscellaneous two-part archive show called, or archive series, I should say, called The Fascist Third Position. We took a look again at Jeannot in some of the material from Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris. Jeannot also figures prominently in a cover story of Mother Jones magazine for May of 1987 by Martin Lee and Kevin Coogan, that article called Europe's New Fascist. So Jeannot is the key person we're going to be looking at here. We're going to take a look also at the Grand Mufti, his role at the Bandung Conference in Indonesia in 1956. It was at that conference that the phrase, or the phrase Third World was coined. And the Grand Mufti, again, a former member of the SS, a bitter anti-Semite and longtime collaborator with Nazi elements, the Grand Mufti played a big role in the Bandung Conference, which again gave rise to the phrase Third World. We're going to take a look at the evolution of the fascist third position. We're going to take a look at the association over the years, not only between people like the Grand Mufti, François Jeannot, Jacques Vergès, the defense attorney for former SS officer and U.S. intelligence agent Klaus Barbie, among others. We're going to take a look at their association with Middle Eastern terrorists and the involvement of European neo-fascists, including neo-Nazi elements, with Middle Eastern terrorism. This Nazi Middle East, Third Reich Middle Eastern terrorist European neo-fascist link is a major element of the fascist third position. In a nutshell, and again, this is obviously something of a telescoping of the situation for the purposes of brevity, but the fascist third position is a type of fascism which incorporates certain elements of progressive politics and in particular aims at drawing on progressive political elements' sympathy for third world national liberation movements in order to basically incorporate them within the ranks of fascism. It's a type of fascism which specifically aims at incorporating certain more progressively oriented individuals disaffected from traditional progressive politics. This has a number of strong historical antecedents. Mussolini himself, the first fascist, was a disaffected socialist, and there was also a significant element of the early German Nazi Party under a fellow named Gregor Strasser, which literally aimed at recruiting disaffected leftists, communists in particular, and recruiting them into the Nazi Party as street goons, as members of the SA, the Brown Shirts. Later, during the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, Strasser and all of his compatriots in that branch of the Nazi Party were liquidated. But the fascist third position is something which has strong historical antecedents and which is a major player on the situation today, and we're going to take a look at how Third Reich elements, how Middle Eastern terrorist elements combine with European neo-fascist elements in order to form the fascist third position. We're going to take a link-ups between people like François Jeannot and Jacques Vergès with organizations like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That's an organization which is being fingered, or part of which is being fingered, as the probable conspirator behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. In the December surprise, as I mentioned, the real blame appears to lie in the direction of Galen and World Anti-Communist League-related elements of our national security establishment that is consistent with the information that's come to light so far about the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing. That's why we're basically taking a look at the evolution of certain elements of Middle Eastern terrorism. We're taking a look at the evolution of the fascist third position, and in particular, a very, very important individual, the link between the past and the present, François Jeannot. And again, Jeannot is an individual who is very heavily involved with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That organization, the PFLP, and again, it is part of the PFLP General Command, which is being fingered as the organization behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. We're going into all of this so that we can come to understand who's behind the PFLP. Because again, that information which has come to light so far, and it's possible that there is some disinformation there, but that information which has come to light so far does indeed point in the direction that I had suggested back in January of 1989, that the real culprits behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 are Galen and Wackel-related elements of our own national security establishment, possibly acting in concert with residual, with Nazi elements around the world. Some of the third position elements involving residual Third Reich elements, Middle Eastern elements, and European neo-fascist elements. And again, if it seems like we're ranging far afield here, do not despair. This is basically so we can understand the historical development behind the forces that appear to have blown up that airplane in December of this year. We're then going to come back after that and review the article with which we began the broadcast, because again, this is a complex piece of information here, the information on Jeannot, the third position, etc. So we're going to review the article with which we began the broadcast by way of sort of tying things together. Then we're going to take a look at a fascinating article from the Arizona Republic of January of 1989, indicating that there were some very curious lapses in security with vis-a-vis Pan Am Flight 103, in particular some U.S. military mail, as well as a document box from manufacturer's Hanover Trust Company in New York, were not searched, despite the fact that that Pan Am Flight 103, or not that particular flight, but despite the fact that there had been warning that a Pan Am flight originating in Frankfurt, which is where the Pan Am Flight 103 originated in, there was warning that a Pan Am flight from Frankfurt would be blown up in December of 1988. In spite of that warning, which turned out to be accurate, there were not only not increased security procedures, but there were remarkable security lapses that we are going to talk about as the situation develops. Now, we're going to take a look, too, at some information which suggests at least the possibility that C4 and not Semtex may have been the explosive that was involved in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. We're also going to take a look at an interesting account. It remains to be seen whether there's anything to it or whether it's so much BS, but an interesting broadcast account in Scotland which said that the bomb had been inadvertently planted in the luggage of a CIA agent. And again, if there's anything to that, it raises the question, of course, how inadvertent this was, whether or not he was really unaware of what was going on, whether he was under mind control, or just what the situation is. Again, interesting, if true, we will take a look at that particular account. We're going to take a look also at some bitterness, or a tremendous amount of bitterness, which has arisen on the part of family members and friends and loved ones of the victims of Pan Am Flight 103. They're going to talk about all the official stonewalling that they have received over this particular case and the fact that, as they, one of them complained, they are being treated like the enemy. We're going to review that, and then we're going to take a look at some information concerning the Reagan administration's institution, basically, of psychological warfare to be practiced on the American public through control of the news media. A number of psychological warfare veterans from the National Security Establishment were employed beginning in January of 1983 to manage the news in such a way as to create popular support for Ronald Reagan's national security policies, in particular his support for the Nicaraguan Contras. We're going to take a look at some of that information. Again, this it can be found from a number of sources. We're going to rely on the book October Surprise by Barbara Honegger for our particular source. But again, it's not difficult information to come up with. Very important, however. Then we're going to take a look at some information concerning Rudolph Giuliani, the former federal prosecutor who is currently the Republican mayoralty candidate in New York City. He went to work after retiring as federal prosecutor. He went to work for the law firm that has acted as the agent for General Noriega of Panama. Of course, there is massive indication of the involvement of General Noriega in not only the cocaine trade, but also in the Contra support effort via his involvement with the cocaine trade. Noriega has been viewed as a CIA asset for some time and appears to have been playing both sides of the fence. Although now a bête noir, although now a villain, it is abundantly clear from the public record that Noriega was in fact a long-time collaborator of the very National Security Establishment in this country, which is seeking to oust him. And it's interesting, again, in light of Rudolph Giuliani's role in a couple of different cases bearing on the December surprise, Pizza Connection 4 and the dismissal of some arms smuggling charges against players in the Iran-Contra scandal, including some people grouped around the late Cyrus Hashemi. Again, it's interesting to see Rudolph Giuliani, who I tagged as a probable inside player, as a probable fixer, in the Iran-Contra scandal, and it's interesting, although obviously not conclusive, to see him going to work for the law firm that has handled Noriega's business in this country. Food for thought and grounds for further research. We're also going to take a look at some information concerning the death of a key AIDS researcher, Irving Seagal, S-I-G-A-L, or Seagal. He had made a key discovery concerning the protein coat of AIDS, and he died in this particular experiment. He worked for the Merck Pharmaceutical Company, and whether or not there is any significance to he being among the many key people that died in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, whether there's any significance to his death, remains to be seen. Of course, we've talked about AIDS as a probable biological warfare experiment by the United States, specifically the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. We took a look at that in Radio Free America program number 16. We're going to take a look at the death of Mr. Seagal, and we're also going to take a look at his work on AIDS, and we're going to take a look also at the Merck Pharmaceutical Company and its historical link with U.S. biological warfare. This may be completely apocryphal under the circumstances, may have nothing whatsoever to do with any intelligence-related or national security-related activity, but interestingly enough, the founder of the U.S. Biological Warfare Research Program, its head during and immediately after World War II, was Mr. Merck of the Merck Pharmaceutical Company. Again, perhaps apocryphal, but we're going to take a look at that and ruminate about its possible significance during the broadcast. And the last item that we're going to look at by way of updating the December surprise, and incidentally next week we're going to take a look at Edward Patrick Purdy, the fellow who shot up all those children at the Stockton schoolyard. And we're going to follow up yet another piece of information in the December surprise. We're going to talk a little bit about Purdy's last stand next week. But the last thing we're going to look at this evening concerns a book that's come out alleging charges of organized crime infiltration of the National Football League and specifically involvement of organized crime in the fixing of NFL games. There's a current book called Interference, How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football by longtime organized crime investigator Dan E. Mulday, a person whose work we've used on this broadcast. Mulday authored the Hoffa Wars, which figures in our Guns of November series. He also is the author of Dark Victory, which was a recent book linking Ronald Reagan with organized crime activities in a definitive way. This comes by way of sort of a light lighthearted, but not unserious, altogether unserious, look at the world of sports. I began the December surprise broadcast by pointing out that Eddie DeBartolo, the owner of the San Francisco 49ers, which are occupying a large amount of public attention, of course, in the Bay Area, that he's part of an organized crime milieu which washes the same waters, which washes the same shores, as many of the same elements involved with the December surprise. Again, I'm not saying ipso facto Eddie DeBartolo is a mafioso, but he's part of a milieu involving organized crime elements, which, again, is part of the same milieu as some of the organized crime elements figuring in the Pizza Connection case, the Pizza Connection case being a key element of the December surprise. So that's what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of tonight's broadcast. Good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. It's time now to get into the main body of the December Surprise update. Now, the December Surprise is a name that I have applied to what I feel is a complex of events which took place in December of 1988. The events certainly took place in or around December of 1988. I feel that these events are related in a way which I am going to describe, and that specifically this complex of events, this complex which I have hypothesized exists and I believe exists, I feel this complex represents the denouement, for all practical purposes, the wrap-up, certainly of the prosecution of Oliver North, but specifically of most of the key elements of the Iran-Contra scandal. I think after the December surprise, the soft and almost shockingly light The soft prosecutions and shockingly light sentencing being given to many of the culprits in this thing, well, basically, that was a foregone conclusion, in my opinion. Now, the December surprise, in a nutshell, involves the relationship between two plane crashes, in particular, the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and the dismissal of conspiracy charges against Oliver North. I also think that the indictment of a number of organized crime figures in yet another investigation stemming from the Pizza Connection case, that this particular case helped to still any tongues that might have wagged in a number of different respects with regard to a number of different cases touching on the Iran-Contra scandal. The Iran-Contra scandal, recall, virtually all of the misdeeds performed under that broad journalistic heading were conducted under the auspices of what is officially known as counterterrorism within the national security establishment. Now, counterterrorism was the subject of cooperation between Oliver North, the White House advisor, national security advisor, who was the main or one of the main people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and the enterprise, so to speak. He was involved with a fellow named Amiram Nir. Amiram Nir was an Israeli security expert, and Amiram Nir worked not only with Oliver North, but also with George Bush, by all accounts, in the Contra support effort. George Bush, by all accounts, was kept closely involved of what was going on. He was regularly briefed by Donald Gregg, his national security advisor, and Gregg was directly tied to Felix Rodriguez, one of the anti-Castro and CIA, one of the anti-Castro Cubans, tied for a long time to the CIA and the intelligence agencies, who was involved with the Contra support effort. Amiram Nir involved with George Bush and Oliver North. He was killed on December 2nd of 1988 in a plane crash, and 2 days after he was killed, it was revealed that he had worked with Oliver North in coordinating U.S. and Israeli counter-terror policy in calendar years 85 and 86. That event on December 2nd, the death of Amiram Nir, along with the announcement on that same day of the indictments in Pizza Connection 4, which I'm going to talk about later in the broadcast, plus the announcement on that day by Ronald Reagan that he would not willingly release documents sought by the Oliver North defense team. Those three events happening on December 2nd, I believe, represent sort of the initiation of the December surprise, the beginning of what we could see as the December surprise. Now, Oliver North's defense team was seeking, among other things, documents concerning the Eria deal. That was a Danish ship spelled E-R-R-I-A, and that ship was taking a bunch of weapons, specifically Kalashnikov rifles, AK-47 rifles, that was going to be used in all probability, or according to a number of accounts, as the main element in a scam to try and link the Contras to support for the El Salvadorian rebels. This contention that the Contras, but the Sandinista government, this contention that the Sandinistas were supporting the El Salvadorian rebels has long been cited as one of the justifications for attempting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Obviously, the main element in that overthrow up until recently was the Contras. Now, again, the Eria deal involved the shipment of a bunch of AK-47s, which may have been used to try and set the Sandinistas up. In any event, Oliver North used as a broker in that deal a fellow named Manzer El-Kassar. Now, Manzer El-Kassar is a Syrian national identified as a terrorist arms supplier and a major drug trafficker who was very closely involved with two people. One of them is Abu Abbas, who we'll talk about in a minute, and the other was Abu Nidal. Both Abu Abbas and Abu Nidal were two of the key players on the terrorist scene in calendar years 85 and 86. Obviously, it was in those 2 years that Amiram Nir and Oliver North were coordinating U.S. and Israeli counter-terror policy. Now, when Pan Am Flight 103 was blown up on December 21st of 1988, and among others, Abu Nidal was cited as one of the probable culprits, or as a possible culprit in this case, any documents within the national security establishment dealing with Abu Nidal or any other major Middle Eastern terrorist group, because there was speculation that a lot of different groups may have been involved, those documents would have become among, if not the most sensitive documents in the U.S. national security establishment, then among the most important documents. When Pan Am Flight 103 was blown up, those documents necessarily would have become relevant to any investigation of that bombing. Therefore, any documents relating to Abu Nidal, and probably those documents sought by Oliver North's defense team, would have had to have remained classified. In other words, Ollie North, is his defense counsel, is seeking, among other things, the documents on the, or some documents on the Eria deal. We also know that once Bob Woodward disclosed the cooperation between Amiram Nir and Oliver North, this was previously secret, but that was, it was basically deemed eligible for public disclosure once Amiram Nir was killed on December 2nd. That, too, would have opened up a whole bunch of documents to the North Defense Team, or would have suggested the presence of a lot of documents that the North Defense Team might have wanted to get their hands on. Certainly, the Amiram Nir-Oliver North cooperation vis-a-vis counter-terror in 1985 and 86, in all probability, would have also had to have remained classified. But again, with Pan Am Flight 103, in all probability, any documents relating to the Eria would have had to have remained classified because they would have borne on the investigation of Pan Am Flight 103. Plus, any attempt at forcing disclosure of those documents would have been extremely unpopular, what with the outrage on the part of the American public and the world over this this particular bombing. Now, a lot of interesting people died in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Not only do I feel that the dismissal of conspiracy charges against Oliver North in January of 1989 was necessitated by the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 for the reasons that I've specified. Any documents relating to the Eria deal and Manzer El-Kassar, in turn tied to Abu Abbas and Abu Nidal, they would have to have remained classified when 103 went down. In addition, a number of State Department and U.S. intelligence counter-terror officials were killed in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. This obviously would have silenced them and eliminated any contribution they might have made concerning any aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, which again goes back many, many years, even before apparently Ronald Reagan's election. Also, the death of Amiram Neer would have eliminated any information he could have contributed. It's my feeling that the deaths not only of the CIA, or the U.S. intelligence and State Department counterterror officials, the elimination of Amiram Neer, but also the arrest of the Pizza Connection forecast, basically served to chill anybody who might have been willing to cooperate in an official capacity with the Iran-Contra investigation. It should also be noted, too, that Rudolph Giuliani, the New York prosecutor who was involved with busting Pizza Connection 4, which I'll talk about later, also was involved in dismissing weapons trafficking charges against a number of players in the Iran-Contra scandal, a number of people involved with, among others, the late Cyrus Hashemi. And that case might not only have borne on the Enterprise per se, but might very well have gone back to the October surprise, an apparent deal cut between the Reagan campaign and the Khomeini government in Iran to keep the U.S. hostages until after Jimmy Carter's election defeat was assured. And again, Rudolph Giuliani figuring not only in the dismissal of charges against those individuals, but also in the bust of Pizza Connection 4, and we'll go into the Pizza Connection in a little bit. I know that's very complicated. It was complicated back when I came up with the hypothesis, and it still is. Basically, again, December 2nd, we have Amiram Neer going down, we have Pizza Connection 4 getting that bust, the indictments are handed down there, and Reagan says he will not willingly release any documents, any secret, any classified documents to the North Defense Team. Then Pan Am Flight 103 goes down on December 21st. The charges against Oliver North are dismissed shortly after that, about 2 weeks after that, in January of 89. On December 4th, remember, Bob Woodward discloses the cooperation between Amiram Neer and North vis-a-vis counterterror. And again, I feel that once Pan Am Flight 103 went down, most of the really sensitive documents sought not only by Oliver North but other people, most of the really sensitive information about the Iran-Contra scandal, and it all basically is subsumed under the heading of, quote, counter-terror, unquote, well, all of that had to remain top secret. I think that when Pan Am Flight 103 went down, all of the dismissal of conspiracy charges against Oliver North and the continued secret status of the documents his defense team was seeking was assured. That, I think, was the central element in this admittedly complex gambit that I believe occurred. Again, I'm presenting a working hypothesis. I can't say for sure that this is what happened, but it is what I believe happened, and I think information will continue to bear that out. A lot of other interesting people died on Pan Am Flight 103. We will talk about that later on in the broadcast. That, in a nutshell, is what the December surprise is about. If it seems confusing, again, it is complicated. I admit it, and I recommend that people get the original broadcast or sit down with the original December surprise broadcast if they have it, and review the information. It's complex, but I think my analysis is right on the money, and I think the information that has come to light since then serves to bear out the working hypothesis that I presented back in January of this year. By the way, for those who eventually hear this program on tape, it is October 8th of 1989, the original broadcast, again, back in January. In the original December surprise broadcast, I stated that the evidence that had come to light so far, or the information that had come to light so far, this again back in January of 89, pointed in the direction of Galen and Wackel-related elements of the U.S. National Security Establishment as the probable culprits behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Now, reviewing very briefly, because it's central to our situation here, the Galen Organization refers to the Nazi Eastern Front Intelligence Organization run by a man named Reinhard Galen, last name G-E-H-L-E-N. Now, Reinhard Galen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front during World War II. At the end of World War II, he jumped with his entire organization to the CIA and became, for all practical purposes, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the official purveyor and sole purveyor for a long time of information concerning the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to our national security establishment. The Galen Organization then in turn went on to become, for all practical purposes, the NATO intelligence organization, and eventually went on to become the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the West German Intelligence Service, and it serves in that capacity today. Obviously, at the distance of 50 years from the beginning of World War II, most of the original people are retired and in most cases dead, but it should be noted that people who were young, some of the junior people in the organization, people in their mid-20s then, are senior officials to this day, plus the fact that the distinctly Nazi character of the Gehlen organization, which incorporated thousands of SS and Gestapo veterans, many of them war criminals of the First Order, the bureaucratic inertia, which carries forward from the early days of the organization to the present in terms of the basic policies BND has pursued, the bureaucratic inertia helps to retain the Gehlen stamp on this organization. Basically, you did not move up in the BND in post-World War II years unless your ideas jogged with those of Gehlen and his associates, and Gehlen was a specifically Third Reich-oriented individual. He was not an unwilling servant of the Third Reich. He was an enthusiastic one, and he maintained the policies of Hitler within his organization. And again, bear in mind, this is the organization which was not only the sole purveyor of intelligence on Russia and Eastern Europe to the United States after World War II, but it also paved the way for many SS and Gestapo veterans to move up into the U.S. National Security Establishment, where many of them, or some of them, occupy senior positions to this day. The current book, Blowback, by Christopher Simpson, goes into the Gehlen organization. Also, Radio Free America shows 1, 2, and 3 talk about the Gehlen organization at considerable length. The third broadcast is explicitly about Gehlen, just Gehlen. Gehlen also figures in a prominent way in Radio Free America shows 11, 14, and 15 as well. So if you want background on the Gehlen organization, those are some places to get it, both from the archives and from a current book. Now, I go into all of this, again, the BND and the Gehlen organization, because it is not only a person who appears to have worked on behalf of the BND, on behalf of the Bundesnachrichtendienst, but also an individual who was working for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, and it was this individual, Marwan Krisat, who is being fingered as the main culprit in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Again, Marwan Krisat's name is spelled capital M-A-R-W-A-N, capital K-H-R-E-E-S-A-T. Krisat works not only for the BND, and a later article says Jordanian intelligence loaned him to BND. He not only works for the West German Intelligence Service, which grew out of the Gehlen Group at the end of the war, but he also works for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Now, the Gehlen organization and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine intersect historically in a way that we're going to examine. And again, this bears directly on the evolution of Middle Eastern terrorism, on the evolution of the fascist third position, and this in turn will bear directly on the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Again, tonight's broadcast is a complex one. You're going to hear a lot of strange names. Bear in mind, again, that the archives here will be a big, big help. And the reason I'm going to all of these strange-sounding names is that these are the names which not only figure in many of the Gehlen-related terrorist developments, which I spoke about earlier, but they figure prominently in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 as well. Reading from the New York Times of Tuesday, May 23rd of 1989, this is a New York Times story by Stephen Engelberg, and it's headlined, Bonn Had Contact in Group Linked to Pan Am Bombing. Stateline, Washington, May 22nd. A Jordanian explosives expert who belonged to a terrorist group suspected of bombing a Pan Am jumbo jet last December worked for West German intelligence late last year, American officials said today. Skipping down. The American officials confirmed a report in the West German magazine Stern, which identified the Jordanian as Marwan Krisat. The magazine quoted two high-ranking security officials as saying that Mr. Krisat, a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, made, quote, radio bombs for attacks on planes, unquote. A spokesman for the West German intelligence agency was quoted by the Associated Press as denying the story, saying, quote, he has never been an agent for BND and he is not one now, unquote. American officials said the Stern account was accurate, but the precise nature of the relationship between Mr. Krisat and German intelligence could not be learned. Skipping down again. American officials said the case against the group is strong but circumstantial. That group, of course, is the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, PFLP, central to our argument here. Repeating that last sentence. American officials said the case against the group is strong but circumstantial. They said American intelligence obtained solid information last year that the Popular Front was preparing to attack Americans in retaliation for the downing of an Iranian jetliner over the Persian Gulf. The officials said the group had approached Iranians all over the Middle East, including in Lebanon, volunteering to carry out the operation. Some detailed information about the group's plan was turned over to the West German authorities, who arrested 16 members of the Popular Front last October. 14 members, including Mr. Krishat, were released soon afterward because of what West German officials termed a lack of evidence. In raids on homes of group members, the West German authorities initially found two bombs of the type later used to destroy the Pan Am plane. American intelligence officials insisted, however, that there were a total of 5 hidden bombs and urged the Germans to redouble their efforts. This eventually resulted in the discovery this year of 2 additional bombs, one of which exploded and killed 2 German security officials. British officials announced earlier this year that the bomb that blew up the jetliner was hidden in a portable radio and cassette player. The bombs found in the raid on the Popular Front's houses were hidden in Toshiba radio cassette players, according to a security alert distributed by the Federal Aviation Administration. So now, as I indicated here, the significant aspects of this article for our purposes are the association between Marwan Krishat and the BND, the West German Intelligence Service. Now, whether or not he was employed as a BND agent or was on loan to the BND by the Jordanian Intelligence Service, as a later article suggests, this is a very interesting connection because, again, the Galen Organization and Middle Eastern terrorism and the sort of extreme Palestinian organizations of which the PFLP is one, well, there is a strong historical link here. And again, the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and a subgroup of that, the General Command, is being identified here as the probable group behind the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Now, bear in mind, whenever a government surfaces an intelligence connection of either its own or somebody else's, this is often done for political purposes, and we may be looking at a cutout. A cutout, basically, is a false scenario which is deliberately floated. That false scenario is enough like the real scenario to lead an investigator down a false pathway, only eventually to bear out in a false investigation. It's basically a form of camouflage. It's a ruse. So you always want to be aware of the possibility of a cutout when you're dealing with an intelligence service here. But the indications from the event itself, from the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, point in this direction. Now, among the interesting people that died in that crash, in addition to the aforementioned State Department and U.S. intelligence counter-terror officials, people who quite possibly Third Reich alumni, of course, it like the Gation, there was a fellow named Michael Bernstein, who was a top U.S. Justice Department, not Third Reich alumni. Of course, it, like the Drug Enforcement Administration, that group is fated to work against other elements of the government that have worked with and on the behalf of that very same group, the group that's being sought. Again, Michael Bernstein, the top OSI investigator, was among the people who died on Pan Am Flight 103. In addition, Bert Karlsson, a Swedish national who was the UN administrator for Namibia, the Southwest African territory which has been administered by the Republic of South Africa and has been the focus not only of a bitter guerrilla war, but a recent peace agreement which may, it remains to be seen, may eventually provide for the independence of Namibia. That was mandated by the United Nations some time ago. South Africa has kept that territory under its boot against international opinion and law for quite some time. Bert Karlsson, anyway, the UN administrator for Namibia, was among the people who died on the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. He was to have been one of the signatories to the Namibian Peace Accord, the signing of which was scheduled for a few days after that plane went down. This is interesting because among the people who was scheduled to be on Pan Am Flight 103 was Roelof Pikbota, the South African foreign minister, who was to have signed the very same Namibian peace accord to which Bernt Karlsson was to have been a signatory. And again, he canceled his reservation shortly before, or a couple of days before the plane was blown up. Now, again, that should be evaluated against the fact that the United States government had warning that the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine was going to try and blow up a Pan Am flight originating in Frankfurt, West Germany, and that's where 103 originated in December of 1988. In spite of that warning, the security procedures were very lax, and as we're going to see, that's led to a lot of controversy. Apparently, though, warning about the individual who has been administering the Namibian city off Peak Bota to cancel his presence on the flight, Bernd Carlson, the late, complained about the individual who has been administering the Namibian situation on behalf of the United Nations. The individual who succeeded Bernd Carlson, I've forgotten his name, he's a Finnish national, basically has been most unsatisfactory, at least to the Southwest African People's Organization, the group that has fought the South Africans for so long. Now, taking a look at the qui bono situation, basically who stands to benefit from the demise of all of these individuals, in the original December surprise broadcast, I stated, and again, it's my belief, that the real culprits here, and I'm not stating...